Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Welcome to Handy Link, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Nicole Palmieri, epilepsy expert. So tell me a little bit about your work surrounding epilepsy.
Sure. My name is Nicole Palmieri, and I'm the Community Engagement and Program Manager at Epilepsy South Central Ontario. So my primary role here is focusing on the various programs that we offer, one of which I'm currently doing, which is our Sunny Days Camp program. So I'm also the camp director for that, and I oversee our Sunny Days Camp program, which is a program offered to children between the ages of 5 to 12 with seizures, as well as their siblings. And offered 8 weeks throughout the summer, every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. So alongside that, I also run our Thinking About Epilepsy Grade 5 program. So we are integrated with the Grade 5 curriculum, where students start to learn about parts of the body, specifically the brain. So we go in and we talk about different types of seizures, and most importantly, seizure first aid. So what should they do if they see a person have a seizure? Outside of that, I'm also responsible for any type of community engagement. So that would be any health and wellness fairs, any government fairs, employment fairs, anything where there is a group of people looking for different information about different services in their community. So we would go, we would set up a booth and provide them with information about epilepsy and seizure first aid.
So I'm curious, since you mentioned a lot of programs geared at younger children, why is it important that these kids have a firm understanding of what epilepsy is and what it really means?
Yeah, so a lot of our children that attend camp have seizures, but haven't necessarily ever seen a seizure, seeing as they are always the ones having the seizures. So, it's an opportunity for them to get together, for them to meet other people with seizures, for them to see other seizures, and just to feel comfortable in a safe place and, be treated like any other child would at any other camp. So sometimes these children have a hard time attending other camps because the staff are not equipped with seizure first aid. So they are required to bring perhaps a worker with them, which can be a cost to the parents as well. So this is an opportunity for them to come to a place where all of the staff are trained in seizure first aid. We are all familiar with the child's seizures and what to do if the child has a seizure. And for them to know that, even if they have a seizure, that, we'll give them time to rest or whatever they need afterwards, and then they can sort of pick up where they left off and continue on with the camp activities. And it's also a great opportunity for siblings as well to meet other siblings who are a sibling of a person living with epilepsy, because it can be really hard on them as well. So understanding it from different perspectives and meeting different people in the same situation can be very helpful.
So do you find that working with a younger audience helps to break down some of the myths and the misconceptions regarding epilepsy that might set in?
Yes, absolutely. So I think that kind of goes hand in hand with our Sunny Days Camp program as well as our grade 5 program. So teaching them at a young age about what epilepsy is and what seizures are, with the hope that as they grow older or as they meet new people, that they can also share information on seizure first aid and different types of seizures. So, you know, the community and the public can become more familiar with what epilepsy is and what seizures are, because I think, you know, with the older population now, there was a lot of myths, there was a lot of stereotypes regarding epilepsy and seizures, and those are hard to break down, especially in the older population. So starting at a young age, I think, is very beneficial in the hopes that they can carry on the information that they've learned and provide more accurate information on epilepsy and seizures.
So in your time with epilepsy work and community engagement, is there any success story that stands out for you?
I think maybe not a specific story, but I think in relation to our camp program, I've been doing this for several years. So I've had, I've been able to see children attend camp perhaps the very first year and who are still attending camp now, and been able to see, you know, the progress that they've made throughout the years. So becoming more comfortable with their seizures, being more comfortable with talking about it or sharing their experiences, and just seeing how much they've evolved as they've gotten older, as well as becoming more comfortable with having epilepsy and having seizures. Because as a small child, I mean, it's not easy to have seizures. Certainly can cause some difficulties at school with the constant fear that one may have a seizure. So, you know, the more educated they become and the more time they spend at our camp, we can definitely see the positive progression and can see how comfortable they've become in hopes that they could possibly even transition to our youth empowerment program and become an advocate for people living with epilepsy.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need for epilepsy awareness and inclusion of all those affected, what would you say?
I would say education. So I truly believe that a lot of the myths that still exist and a lot of the stereotypes that still exist are based around misinformation or lack of education. So we are very, or I am, you know, a very strong advocate for connecting with our agency and getting somebody to come out and provide proper epilepsy and seizure first aid information to a workplace, an agency, a camp, staff for a camp, anything and everything, because we truly find, you know, when I'm going into places and I'm giving this information, I kind of see a lot of aha moments where people are like, oh, I didn't realize that, or I didn't know that that existed, or I didn't know that that's what I was supposed to do. So there's definitely a lot of information. So I really, you know, strongly would recommend getting proper education. We offer a lot of material on our website, and we have a lot of hard copies in our office as well. So a lot of information could be shared, and I really, you know, truly believe that that will, that that is what's going to help break down the still existing myths and stereotypes.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
In this next segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Sean Kehoe, who'll be sharing his story of life with epilepsy. So tell me a little bit about your experiences with epilepsy.
So I was diagnosed with epilepsy when I was 17. I'm now 34. It was caused from scar tissue from brain surgeries I had earlier in life for another medical condition. I had many seizures. I had brain surgery about a year in. It went away for about 8 months. We all thought it was all put together, ready to move on with life. It came back, and it came back with thunder. I was having about 20 seizures a day, grand mals and complex partials. I couldn't go to school, couldn't go to work. I had a three-year-old son at the time, couldn't be alone with him, couldn't pick him up. My father had to take 2 years off work because I couldn't be left alone anywhere. someone had to be watching me 24/7 because I had a grand mal once, fell down two flights of stairs and broke every bone in my body, basically. So this went on for years. I had a number of brain surgeries. I'd had about 20 seizures a day off and on. So my memory is a bit cloudy during that time in life. But after a number of surgeries, number of medications, number of crazy experiences, things would calm down but never stop. And then one day, a friend of mine told me about omega-3 fish oil and what it can help from my seizures. Not that it would be a cure or anything, but it could be a piece of the puzzle, along with my surgeries and my medication and everything else that's helping. I tried it. And to make a long story short, I haven't had a seizure since. It was 9 years seizure-free officially yesterday.
So what were some of the challenges that you faced when you realized that this was going to be a big part of your life, that epilepsy was something you were going to have to deal with?
So some of the challenges, the biggest challenge for me was my son. So I couldn't be with my son alone. Someone had to be with us 24/7 because he was too young to understand what was going on. He didn't know what to do when I had a seizure. That was my biggest. And then he was later on diagnosed with diabetes, and I wasn't allowed to give him his insulin because it wasn't safe for me to do so with a needle in my hand and with the possibility of me having a seizure. That was incredibly difficult, and it took some strength to deal with it. Also, I was unable to go to school. I tried to go back part-time, but I was having so many seizures I had to stop. My memory was so cloudy because of all my seizures. So I had a hard time remembering things, remembering where I am, remembering almost everything. So those were some of the biggest, and socially. Socially, a lot of friends would people say, that, oh, we can handle it, don't worry, it's okay. But they see a seizure, and everyone panics. It's not their fault, but you come out of a seizure, and you see all these people panicking and crying and freaking out, and eventually you start to feel like it's your fault. And it's a very challenging thing to bring yourself out of that and realize it's not your fault. You're not doing this to these people.
So what were some of the support systems that helped you cope with the tougher times?
Well, Epilepsy Ottawa Carleton have been, I can't even put into words what they've done for me. Meeting other people with epilepsy changed my life. It's so much easier to talk about epilepsy when you know the people around you have been through it as well. They know what you're talking about. They didn't just look it up on a news article. So the people that I've met have, I can't even put into words what they've done for me. They know who they are. They know who I'm talking about. I love all you guys, and I would not be here without you. So that was the biggest one. My friends, family, just a lot of, and I'm a big weightlifter. Fitness has been my passion my whole life. And the people in the gym treated me good. They watched me to make sure I wouldn't hurt myself having seizures. That was my therapy when I was going through my worst spell with epilepsy, because I couldn't go to school, I couldn't go to work, but I could go to the gym, because the gym owner or the manager was someone I went to college with. He would keep an eye on me while I trained, and that was a huge, huge piece of what got me through my battle.
So, if you could send any one message about this condition and what it really means to the community, what would you say?
My message would be, you are not the condition. You're a person, and don't let this condition beat you. The words I live by and I tell everyone are, believe in yourself and you can get through anything. It's going to be a different path. Everybody's brain, everybody's body is different. What's going to help your epilepsy is going to be different than the person beside you. But there's a will. Where there's a will, there's a way. And just never close your eyes and never give up.
So do you think there's enough education out there about this condition? Or do you think the school system and the public could take it more upon themselves to get the word out?
We're not even close to enough education yet, but we're getting there. The ball is finally starting to roll. I'm getting more and more reach outs from people, more people that are aware of it. It's coming, but we're not even close to enough awareness and education upon it. Not even close.
So that being said, if you could see anything added to the existing education and the methods used, what would it be?
The biggest one that I'm really impressed with lately, I don't know, have you seen that video that's recently come out about how to deal with someone when they have a seizure?
Yes.
That was fantastic, because most people, that's how you learn something. That's how you it's visual. You see it. YouTube's a big thing these days. I'd like everyone to be forced to watch that video. before at school and work and everything, because when I first went back to work, I was off for 6 or 7 years because of my epilepsy. When I first went back, I was told I didn't have to tell anyone, but I wanted to. I wanted the people around me to know in case I don't want anybody panicking if I had a seizure in their office. If I had that video, I would have done a presentation in front of everybody.
So, one sec. So do you find that people with epilepsy are as motivated or as capable in a workplace setting as their able-bodied counterparts, that they have the same drive and determination?
As a person without epilepsy?
Yes. Do you think they're capable in a workplace setting?
They're definitely capable, but the biggest thing that I've noticed is that people are so hard on themselves, and myself included. When I had a seizure, I would bring it upon me. I would say it's my fault. I did this, and it pulls away from your ability to focus and perform at work because you think you're burdening the people around you. So that's the biggest burden I'm trying to help get off other people with epilepsy's backs, saying you're more than capable. You can do this. It's going to be a different road than a perfectly healthy person, but you can do this, and it's not your fault.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Yep.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
The GATA Network is back in full swing with the annual GATA Academy happening on September 5th from 9 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. in Dillon Hall. This series of interactive workshops is led by experienced professionals from different backgrounds across campus. The GAT Academy will feature resources and activities relevant to new and experienced GAs and TAs. Topics include classroom technology, creating and conducting effective labs and tutorials, best practices in grading and feedback, and so much more. To register, visit cleo.uwindsor.ca/workshops. That's Tuesday, September 5th, from 9 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. Get ready for the fall semester with the GATA Network.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard stories of epilepsy from Nicole Palmieri and Sean Kehoe. In this segment of our show, we'll hear about life with MS from special guest Shannon Campbell. Before we get to our interview, though, I want to thank recent guest Emily McIntyre for referring Shannon to the show. So tell me a little bit about your story of dealing with MS.
Well, I got diagnosed when I was in fourth year university. I lost the use of my hand for 12 weeks. It just felt like pins and needles. So it was very confusing when I was in school because I didn't really know what was going on. And now I was actually diagnosed in 2008, so it's almost 10 years now living with it. So MS is something that it affects me daily for sure. But I kind of try to make it not. Like, I try to do my best to not allow it to. Does that make sense?
So, could you tell me a little bit about some of the methods you've used to cope with the condition?
Well, I know. Because everybody who has MS has different symptoms and different things affect them. But with my MS, I'm always cold. So I always make sure I have extra clothing and stuff like that on me. And I don't put myself in situations where I don't have the ability to go to the washroom when I need it, because that's still something that I have to deal with. So in the mornings, I always make sure I go to the bathroom before I leave, because if I'm on the road and I have to go, it's going to come, and I don't really have any control of that. So I always try to make sure that before I leave my house, I always go to the washroom. I don't drink coffee and stuff like that because then I don't really have any control. So I just kind of altered my life to not drink coffee, not drink things that are going to make me have even less control. So, and even like when I like I don't know, even if I do simple tasks like doing dishes, sometimes if I'm doing them for too long, then my body will hurt. So I'll have to do dishes, like do one round of dishes and then go sit down, take a break, and then come back to doing them because my body is, I definitely have like chronically back pain. So I kind of have to like stall my activities so I don't get too tired.
So what would you say has been the greatest challenge that you faced dealing with the condition?
I guess just not knowing the unknown. Because it can just, I never know. Because of the MS I have, it's relapsing and remitting. So I'm on a very good medication, and I haven't had an attack since 2010 that I was hospitalized for, but still I get like just these daily like pains and stuff that I just kind of, I try to just brush them off like it's nothing, but I know it's just the fact that that's part of the disease. So sometimes I can't get down on myself because I know it's not my fault, that's the disease, so it's not something that I'm doing wrong. The cards I've been given, you know? And I try to stay positive because I know there's a lot of other people in the world and that they're a lot worse. So
to keep positive, what have you found to be the most effective to sort of keep you on course, to recognize your own abilities and how you can and cannot get things done?
I try to surround myself with positive people. And I really like kids, and I have a lot of friends with kids and stuff, and I find joy in like being around them and doing stuff with them because they're the ones who they're never gonna judge me of how I walk or how I am. They just love me, so I don't know. I use their relationship to make my life like makes me better because I know that no matter what, these kids will always love me and they'll always be there. And it's just something that I do. A lot of people are always like, oh, why are you so nice? Or why are you so nice to people? I said, you don't know. You don't know what any, because of my disease and because, or whatever it is. I don't know if it's a disease, condition, disability, or whatever you want to call it. It's invisible. So a lot of people don't understand. Because, like, if I say it, I say, oh, I can't do that. I'm like, why? I'm like, well, I have MS. And they're like, no, you don't. I'm like, yeah, I do. Just because I'm still a physical person and active, my MS is hidden. A lot of people don't know. And then when I tell them I have it, they think I'm lying or something. But I don't know why anybody would lie about that. But
So when it comes to dealing with any condition, I think you've got exactly the right approach because these children understand something like MS is just natural at a young age. They're going to grow up with that wisdom, that understanding.
For sure.
So are there any steps you've taken to spread the word and raise awareness about your condition?
Every single year, my family does the MS walk in Mississauga, and my mom is a very, very avid supporter of getting sponsors, raising money, and I'm lucky enough that she works in a hospital, and she has been there for a long time, so she has a lot of doctor friends, so every year she's raised a lot of money for the society, and I know when I was on my old drug, we had a meeting with like the deputy health because I was in teacher's college. I was turning 25, and they were government or whatever. They said that they weren't gonna cover my MS drug because it was. This was the old drug I was on. It's called Tysabri, and it was too new of a drug, and it was a drug that came out, I believe, if I remember correctly, I believe it came out in 2006, I think. But then a couple of people in the study ended up dying because they were using this medication and another MS medication. And with MS, one medication doesn't really, like, when you're on one medication, you have to kind of have, like, a drug break before you go on to another medication. So the two medications, they don't work together. And so two of the study patients ended up dying. So then they pulled it off the shelves. And then I believe, if I remember correctly, in 2008 or 9, they brought it back because they realized that it was a good drug. And it was, I think it was just because, like, the scare of somebody dying. That's why it kind of got pulled off the shelves. But then I was on it from 2008. And then in 2010, this is when I had to change my drugs because I was finishing teacher's college. And I was 25. So my drug was not covered anymore under my dad's insurance. And this therapy was like $4,000 a month. So obviously I was working part-time teaching. I had two part-time jobs, teaching skating and teaching swimming. And that didn't cover my drugs. So we had a meeting with the deputy health minister and kind of just talked to her and said, like, how come I can't be covered? Like, I'm active member of society. I'm trying to do a good thing and whatever. And ever since I was on Tisabri was always such a great company, and they saw that my MS was very, very severe and that I needed it to live. So they had always been a drug company. They have always covered the drug for me. So when we had the meeting with the deputy minister of health, we tried to just advocate for all the people who couldn't advocate for themselves, saying, how is it fair that you have three MS drugs that are good, that are covered, and then you have this MS drug that's amazing, but it's not covered. So why would you cover the drugs that are good and not cover the one that's, like, amazing? And now, so many years later, I'm on a different drug, and the drug that I've been on, I think it's been about 2 years now, and it's just a pill. It seems to be even better. But I wouldn't have, I don't think I would have been able to go on this drug if me and my mom didn't. We worked with the MS Society, and we really, like, tried to fight this because it's not fair to somebody. Because, like, I don't know why I got MS. There's no MS in my family. I don't know what the reason was. I was one of the people who, you know, did the right thing, went to university, went to teacher's college, like, did what I was supposed to do. And then I ended up getting sick. So I'm not, like, it's just very sad that there isn't enough people who, like, in the government that care about this. And I'm not saying I'm the only person, because there's thousands, millions of different kind of conditions that need to be more informed on and more information. But just the fact that MS is something like MS is a very Canadian disease, and the fact that it kind of didn't seem like anybody cared, and that's what I got out of it when we used to always go and try to fight to get the drug comfort. I just remember always telling my mom, like, nobody cares. Like, nobody cares about you. And it's sad when you have to, when you have to feel like nobody cares and nobody's there to help you. But in those times when we were fighting for this and stuff, that's how I felt. And
no person with a disability or without should ever be made to feel that nobody cares. For the fact is, any condition, whether one person has it or a billion people have it, is worthy of attention, is worthy of compassion, is worthy of hope. Fact is, people do care. It's just knowing where to look. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you We're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.